From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. Finding Nemo is an animated movie about an overprotective clownfish searching for his son. These colorful characters have captured moviegoers' imaginations. But real-life clownfish have scientists spellbound as well. This week, a new report in the journal Nature announced that clownfish have a curious talent. They can change their sex and their size to precisely fit into their fishy social strata. Joining me to talk clownfish is Dr. Peter Buston. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Welcome to the program, Dr. Buston.
Thanks very much.
I gather you're not in the University of California, Santa Barbara right at this moment.
Not right now, no.
Out of the country, eh?
Yeah, I'm out taking a little vacation and doing some work in Spain.
Nice. I'd like to invite our callers to join this discussion about clownfish. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK or 1-800-989-8255. So what's life really like for a clownfish?
I have to say that it's maybe a little bit boring. They spend their entire lives in one anemone, which is about maybe half a meter across, and they never leave it.
Now, remind us what an anemone is, and then maybe before you even do that, maybe you should tell us what a clownfish looks like. I mean, they're colorful, I presume, from the name.
They are very colorful, and if you've seen Finding Nemo, they look just like Nemo. They're anywhere from just a couple of centimeters long to 5 centimeters long, bright orange with 3 white bars, and the bars are bordered with black. They're really photogenic little fish. Uh-huh. And they live in an anemone, which is a bit like an upside-down jellyfish on the bottom of the seafloor or on a coral reef. And these anemones, they sting pretty much all other fish, but the clownfish are immune to their sting, and they find a safe haven there.
Yeah, I have to say, I asked about the what they really look like, because even though I saw Finding Nemo, I didn't see it with a marine ecologist, and so I wasn't certain they had gotten it right. But
no,
you said they did.
They did. It's pretty right.
But what I didn't understand from the movie, since that's where a lot of my information about clownfish comes from, is what's the nature of this relationship between anemones and clownfish? And I know that's not your research focus, but I think I just can't let it go without asking that.
It's very clear that the clownfish get protection within the anemone. So they're protected from predators there. Mm-hmm. And within the anemone, they have very low mortality, very low death rate. But outside of the anemone, they're rapidly preyed upon just because they're not very good swimmers. Huh. But it's not clear what the anemone gets out of the relationship, and if indeed the anemone gets anything out of the relationship. So...
really,
it seems to vary from place to place.
Sounds like a good deal. I mean, if you could find that, someone is going to sting your enemies and not mind you being around, or at least tolerate it. That sounds okay. All right, so let's talk about social structure in clownfish and why a clownfish would want to change sex.
Why it would want to change sex is still a little bit of an open question. That's theory I'm working on now at Santa Barbara in collaboration with some others. And it's not well worked out exactly why they do change sex.
But they do. I mean, when do they change sex?
So within each social group, there's so groups vary in size from sort of 2 to 6 individuals. Usually there's about 4. And within each group, the largest fish is always the female. The second largest is always the male. And the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th are non-breeders. So if the female dies, for instance, just of old age or something like that, then the male changes sex and becomes a female, and it's the largest non-breeder that becomes the male, becomes the new male. And then this new couple breeds together.
And any idea why women are always at the top, or females are always at the top of a clownfish hierarchy?
Probably because, as a as a couple, the pair does best, has the most offspring, if the larger one of them is female. That's the sort of standard way of thinking about it, because the number of eggs a fish can produce tends to be limited by its body size. So just the partners, the breeding pair, can just have more kids, more offspring, if the largest one is female.
Okay. And what about this changing size business? I mean, is that like just they start eating more, or do their bodies force them to eat more? How do they start growing faster? Or why do they stop growing faster?
The mechanisms aren't well worked out. So what's clear is that they can just vary their growth rate pretty much as a sort of behavioral decision. They can choose whether to grow very little or a lot. And how they do that, whether it's just by altering how much they eat, we don't know yet. But it could also be that they there's some hormonal change that takes place, which just makes them grow a lot or grow a little. The sort of focus of my work has been understanding why they should want to grow a lot or why they should not want to grow at all. And it's a slightly different question.
Interesting, though. Yeah, it's curious. Well, I'd like to invite our listeners to join in with their clownfish queries. Can I really say that? Clownfish queries? I guess I can.
If you say it slowly.
Yeah. Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Matthew in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Matthew, what's your question?
Hi. I have a coral reef aquarium, and approximately 2 years ago, I bought a pair of young tank-bred Ocellaris clowns. They were about the same size at the time. Over the course of about 6 months, one obviously ate more than the other one and was also much more aggressive than the other one and grew to be almost twice the size of the other one, leading me to believe I had a male and a female. Very recently, about 2 months ago, the female, the larger, jumped out of the tank, unfortunately, and died. Since then, the male has started eating a great deal more. It has
right.
grown approximately half an inch.
Right.
It appears to have changed sex.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So you've demonstrated in your fish tank what Dr. Buston is describing.
Apparently I have.
Well, without the full social hierarchy, but...
And not as rigidly scientifically proven, I'm sure.
Well, that's a very interesting story, Matthew. So I got to ask you now, Dr. Buston, did you, were you in Papua New Guinea looking for these fish, or were you also using a fish tank to do your studies?
No, there have been a lot of aquarium studies, and you can get lots of sort of, let's say, weird and wonderful behaviors taking place in aquaria. So I did all my work actually on the reefs in Papua New Guinea, and I studied about 100 social groups of these fish out there in the wild, where they tend to behave much more naturally, if you like.
Sounds like the right place to do it. Matthew, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's hear from Virginia in Cleveland. I guess that's Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. My question is... the ability to have both sexes, isn't that not a kind of an evolutionary, instinctual thing that keeps them going and going and going, and that's how they have maintained so long, or what?
Huh. What do you think, Dr. Buston?
So there's a lot of animals that are actually hermaphrodites, so they can be both male and female in their lifetime. And it's certain that that's a sort of trait that's been favored by evolution. Some animals can just have more offspring in their lifetime if they function as males for part of their lifetime and then function as females for another part. And so you can get hermaphrodites that are male first and then female, or female first then male, or you can get individuals that just can flip-flop back and forth between male and female depending on social conditions.
Virginia, thanks very much for that question. Let's go to Eric in Southern California. Eric, welcome to Talk of the Nation Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for having me on. My question is, maybe this is sort of clownfish social engineering, but have you done any experiments where you sort of force social groups, for example, two dominant females, and do they tend to work things out, or, in some sort of a non-aggressive fashion where one will become the male, and does it actually, will it actually get smaller? Have you been able to do any experiments like that to, or again, maybe this is just a bad engineer, social engineering, but had anything like that that you've looked at?
Things like that have been done, and it seems that if there's a big enough size difference between the individuals you put together, then they can stay together pretty peacefully. But if you put two individuals together of very similar size, they tend to have lethal fights, and so one of them ends up being killed or damaged until the size hierarchy gets sorted out.
Interesting.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, I assume you might have other, would you have similar problems if, for example, you lost both the dominant male and female, and the non-breeders have to sort things out, or is that, again, it's all size-based?
It's all size-based, and so there's a size hierarchy even within the non-breeders, and trouble seems to occur between individuals when they're similar in size and when their dominance relationships aren't clear. And it either ends up with one individual sort of growing away from another one, so there's a clear size difference between them, or it ends up with one of them being evicted from the anemone, and then that's the same as being killed, because you get eaten as soon as you're evicted from the anemone.
Eric, thanks so much for your call. It's making me wonder if you have a really, again, this is anthropomorphizing, I suppose, but do you ever get a clownfish at the bottom of the social hierarchy who said, I've had enough of this, and just starts to grow more?
Apparently not, and I think it's just because it's just too easy for them to be evicted. The anemones are small, there's nowhere to hide really within the anemone from the other clownfish, and so if an individual starts to try and grow more, it's going to come into conflict with the sort of individual immediately above it in the hierarchy, and then what seems to happen is that it gets evicted. So since eviction is such a horrible fate, they tend to restrict their growth until there's space for them to grow a bit more.
Right. So stay small and survive. Let's go to David in Charleston, South Carolina. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My question is, I have a pair of false percula that I purchased on the 4th of July, 1998, and they're 5 years old now. And the first year or two, they exhibited what I would call false mating behavior, where they would gyrate or shimmy next to one another, but I haven't seen that, and they've remained the same size, and I wondered if you had any insight into what might be going on with these guys, and how long do you know how long they may live?
They may live a very, very long time. There are definitely reports of individuals in the wild living 10, 15 years. There are reports from aquaria that say they can live up to 20 years. And based on the sort of mortality rates, the death rates that I saw in a year, it suggests that if a fish in the wild gets to be a female, it can be over 30 years old.
Wow.
They really seem to be remarkably long-lived, highly social animals.
Wow, 30 years old. Well, that means, David, you might have made a sound investment. You've got 25 years to go.
I guess so, and I guess that people that are buying them in the frenzy of the Nemo fad should take that into consideration, that they may have companions for a lot longer than the standard goldfish.
David, thanks for your call. I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, actually, that raises another question. What's the pressure on this species if everybody's snapping up clownfish after this movie? Are they going to get wiped out by Disney's success?
I hope not. I hope that people look at the movie and see that Nemo would be much happier in the wild. But clearly there is intense pressure on these clownfish. They have been wiped out off some reefs in the Solomon Islands and some other places. Hopefully that pressure won't get more intense, because they can be captive reared too. They're one of the, at least false clowns can be pretty easily captive reared. So hopefully people are paying attention if they're buying them, and they're buying captive reared fish and not fish that have been collected from the wild, because their, I mean, to replace a stock of these fish in the wild is going to take an enormous amount of time because they're so long-lived.
How easy are they? I mean, do you have to have a group of them, or will they be happy just one at a time in a tank?
I don't know how happy they would be on their own.
Okay.
But I've seen pairs in aquaria that look reasonably content.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to Al in Anchorage, Alaska. Al, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a real treat. My question is this. When the female dies, as best I can tell from your conversation, three things happen. The male turns into the female. The first of the non-breeders turns into a male, and then somehow they recruit, apparently, another non-breeder. How do they know what to do this? I mean, is this a chemical thing? Is it a social thing? They don't figure it out in their little minds. What mechanism is there that allows for all of this to happen? And then the final thing is where they get the third non-breeder when this is all done.
Okay. That's a great set of questions.
We're going to have to see if we can tackle them in about a minute and a half, though.
Okay. I think the mechanism can just be a simple mechanism. Like, if there's an individual above you in the hierarchy, then sort of who's not changing, then you don't change. So if the female disappears, suddenly there's no visual stimulus for the male of an individual bigger than it. So it changes sex. And then the third individual now doesn't have a male in front of it. It has a female in front of it. So it can change sex, too. So a combination of probably visual cues and chemical cues. And then they recruit a new individual at the bottom of the hierarchy. These larval settlers are coming into anemones all the time, but they're usually driven off. Their recruitment is usually prevented. But once there's space at the bottom of the hierarchy, these larval settlers will come in and they'll be allowed to stay. And then they just join in the hierarchy.
Huh. So, Al, is this tempt you to go into clownfish research yourself? I guess you don't get a whole lot of those up in Anchorage. Oh, I guess Al has left us. Okay, well, actually, that's just about all the time we have this hour. Just quickly, Dr. Buston, are you going back to Papua New Guinea, or are you going to be working in your lab for a while?
I'm working in Santa Barbara for another year or another couple of years, and then hopefully be getting back to New Guinea to explore some more ideas out there.
Sounds like an interesting place to do research. Anyway, we've run out of time. Thanks for talking with me this hour, Dr. Buston. Peter Buston is a postdoctoral fellow at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thanks.